everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week I'm happy to say we have John Gillis on the show. He's been on the show before, but we're very happy to have him back to talk about his book, The Human Shore, Seacoasts in History. I think I'm the perfect person to interview John because I'm from the Midwest. And I grew up in the Midwest. I spent most of my time in the Midwest. And I did eventually make it to a couple of shores, namely ones in California, obviously, and then in Massachusetts. But I have spent a lot of time in the interior, as he calls it. But I am strangely drawn to shores. In fact, I remember very vividly the first time I saw the ocean in California when I was about 15. And that was made quite an impression on me. And I have to say, I do love the beach. So having said that, John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely, my pleasure. So, John, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Marshall. I'm not unlike you. Actually, my parents came from the Midwest. I grew up, my formative years were really in Buffalo, New York, which is about as interior as you can get.
Yeah, that counts. That definitely counts.
I like Rachel Carson, who is my my mentor in all these things, discovered the shore late. She didn't discover the shore until she was in her, I think, in her 20s. And by the way, she never learned to swim. So her accomplishment as a marine biologist is really quite stupendous. But what I discovered in reading her work, where she talks about how we came from the sea and we will all return at one point or another to the sea, that is, as a human species, if we survive that long, alerted me to the fact that my own history, my own small contribution to the history of our species was a track that came from the interior back to the sea. And the discoveries that I have made there over time, working first on islands. Islands of the Mind was my first book of this kind. And then in my transition to an environmental historian, discovering the shore as the first home of mankind alerted me to feeling that I was participating in something larger than myself. And I think that's what carries history forward, is when historians and indeed readers of history discover that they are participating as well as thinking and writing about their particular subject. So that's my trajectory.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us, I mean, you've kind of already answered the question, or at least indicated an answer. This is an unusual book. I will say that. It's an unusual book. I've not really ever read it. That's good. That's a good thing. Why did you write The Human Shore, Seacoasts in History?
Well, my personal experience of the shore is now a bi-coastal one. We live in Berkeley during the winter months, and then for more than 40 summers, we have spent most of the summer on a small island off the coast of Maine, called Great Gott Island. It's not very great. In fact, it has a little neighbor we call Little Gott. But I have been deeply moved, infected, not by simple-minded islamania, which I am critical of, but I have been moved to think about the shore to which that island belongs, that is the coast of Maine, as a place very special. And I hope I've conveyed some of that, as well as the general outlines of shores around the world in this book, The mm-hmm. Human Shore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I emphasize that the title Human Shore makes it, I hope, makes it clear that the shore is not some kind of natural feature that that we inhabit for longer or shorter periods during the year, but it is a product of our human history as much as it is the product of the natural histories of all the plants and creatures that we share that shore with. So we must begin to treat the shore, in my view, as our human home, if we are to get anywhere in this terrible crisis that we're now involved in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So this is a contribution to, would you call it environmental history or world history?
Yes, I definitely would.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
Which is a new field for me, but like Edward Thompson used to say, as he talked about his work, he was seized by the subject of working class history. I've been seized by the subject of environmental history. It's very, very compelling, and it is so new, and it is so open that you can do so many different things with it.
So, as I said in the pre-interview, the book is arranged chronologically, which I think most history books should be, but that's just my prejudice. And you begin with what we call, wrongly, I think, the prehistoric period. That is the period of the period of evolution, and then the period after which, about 180,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens first appeared in Africa. And one of the arguments you make is that they head to the shore pretty quick, although they do evolve in the interior of Africa, right? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, and of course, there are many variations on the human theme. We're still not quite clear on what we mean by humanity. But let's take Homo sapiens. It's pretty clear now from new research that Homo sapiens began to differentiate from other forms of humanity, if you can call it that, about 200,000 years ago, when they came down to the shore from the interior of Africa in what was actually a great environmental crisis of the time. The center of Africa dried out. They had no place to go. They came down to a shore that they were unfamiliar with. They discovered there the riches of the tidal zone, the shellfish, the seaweed, the various kinds of minerals and lipids that then allowed them, and this is not entirely clear yet, but to expand their neurological abilities. And from that point, there's no doubt about this, from that point onward, they had continued to come and go from the shore. But about 50,000 years later, they began to depart from the African shore and move shore-wise or coast-wise around the globe to Australia, then ultimately to the Americas, and they completed the loop, shall we say, not coming out of interiors, but often along shores where the riches of the environment allowed them to develop, progress, and to invent and to thrive culturally as well as materially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's been well established that, in fact, they did move along the Eurasian littoral, I guess we could call it, and then populate Australia, and then they made it up over the land bridge, I guess, 20,000 years ago. They came over to what we call the Near East about 60,000 years ago, if I recall.
They were there earlier than that. But the people that we, I think, genuinely regard as our ancestors came various ways out of Africa. But what the striking thing is how quickly they moved once they got into this littoral or coastal position. And I would argue, and this, I'd be happy to have challengers on this, that we've really gotten history basically wrong when we think of it as a landlocked operation with occasional forays out into the blue sea. The fact is that most of human history has occurred at or near coasts, and that the interiors have been far less productive and creative than have been the littoral. So, looking at it from this perspective, I challenge, for example, the mythology of the Bible, which locates Eden in an interior space, and suggest that maybe we got that one wrong, too. But once it gets embedded in religion, of course, it becomes a religion. So these are very hard habits of thought to dislodge. And I'm just trying to dislodge this kind of interior thinking and direct people to the coast. Mm-hmm. The place of history.
It's interesting because I was just teaching, for whatever reason, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh, I don't think, does go near the sea. But then the next thing we read was the Iliad, which is pretty much all about being by the sea.
I know. Isn't that interesting?
No. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it is interesting. So one of the things you have to say, which is kind of controversial in terms of chronology, is that most historians, and I think all historical anthropologists, would make an enormous break about 10,000 years ago when there was a transition between what we might call casual horticulture to organized agriculture. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. Again, of course, that was an enormous break, and out of it came urban civilization and taxation and states a great power and military force. But long before that, people at the shore were living a very civilized life, probably at a higher level of nutrition and human health than anybody grubbing ground. And yet, this is one of our things. We have our favorite ancestor myths, and whether it be the American pioneer or the Aboriginal agriculturalist, these are our ancestors in our view, and I'm trying to change that view.
Mm-hmm. So, why would we? I know you're trying to change that view, but why would we change our view of that? I mean, it seems to me that, much of what we know about prehistoric settlement, for example, of Europe, indicates moving from, and I could be totally wrong here, indicates moving from the coast to the interior.
Well, yes and no. We were all taught Western Civ. Where did we go? Start out with Rome, move into the feudal period, the image of that is a completely landlocked existence. And then comes along the Renaissance and exploration. People move out. But the fact is that throughout this whole period, the shore was a place of lively interaction between land and sea. Most fishermen were farmers, and farmers were also fishermen. And it's that story which I try to tell here. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do is simply loosen up categories sufficiently for people to look at themselves and look at our current situation in a different way and appreciate the shore for what it is and not abuse it any longer in the way we have to treat it as an autonomous and important part of our legacy, and to try to understand how to live with the sea at the shore rather than on the sea, on shore.
Well, I mean, here's a very simple question, and I don't know the answer to it. When were the first boats invented? They definitely must have been invented, 40,000 or so years ago when humans went to Australia. There's no other way to get there, right? I mean, am I wrong?
That's a controversy. They could have rafted over. It depends.
Being a Midwesterner, I don't make a distinction between rafts and boats.
Rafts and boats. Huck is with us still. I think even now the first boat is an indefinite, maybe 50,000 years, maybe before that. But as far as a maritime society is concerned, I think we have to be careful if we don't want to landlock ourselves on one side. We don't want to deep six ourselves on the other side. In fact, most maritime activity has always occurred close to the shore or along the shore. Mm-hmm. Now, that's true of the Mediterranean. Braudel talks a lot about this. It was certainly true of early modern Europe. It was true of the Americas. It's quite recently that humans have had the capacity to go to sea and remain at sea away from the shore for long periods. And we, you know, we're kind of fascinated with that. I mean, there's O'Brien's novels and all kinds of, you know, deep water you know, fantasies. I'm a little bit skeptical of that because that does not represent the majority of activity at sea along the shore mm-hmm. for the millennia.
Sure. I was just thinking of the next phase that you deal with. This is after the so-called prehistoric phase, and this gets us into, you know, what I would call kind of modern times, but we call it classical civilization. Then we see all of the major civilizations on Earth, they have boats of some sort. They can't be able to go into blue water, but they can definitely move, for example, across the Mediterranean, as we see in the Iliad and the Odyssey, where there's an entire civilization in which this is just second nature to build boats and to live near the coast, because that's what you did.
Yes, that's true. And this is where you begin to get trading civilizations, which use the coast as a great marketplace for the world. I mean, in fact, ports and port cities came rather late. What people would do is lay out their goods on the shore and hold a silent market they would hope that the locals would come down, have a look, make a counteroffer, and then the trade would be consummated. Mm-hmm. So once again, we need to think about the ways the shore has been used in other than our modern perception of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that after the invention of, you know, not exactly ocean-going boats, but at least boats that could move up and down the littoral with large cargoes, that then you see the first really coastal cities. Because we know the cities of the ancient world were not coastal, at least the very early ones, the ones that we find, for example, in Mesopotamia. They're not. They're riparian. That is, they're on rivers. They have to be on rivers for reasons having to do with water, that is, fresh water. But it's only after you see boats that you see, like, you know, even Rome. Rome is not on the ocean, but Alexandria is.
No, that's true.
You see what I mean? Yeah.
No, I think you've made an excellent point there.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. But I'm once again, I'm just a little bit hesitant to endorse too much of the maritime history as a history of boats.
I wasn't thinking of a history of boats. I just thought that at that point, you know, it becomes kind of commonsensical that you would. Once you have coastal trade, then it makes sense to have cities on the coast. And it also makes sense, actually, to move large populations, which is one of the things you talk about, this sort of movement to the coasts, the first movement to the coasts.
Yeah, but remember, Marshall, how late that occurred. I mean, in the Middle Ages, for example, all the major cities of Europe were upriver. Mm-hmm. And river, you need a really good book, comparative book on rivers and civilizations, which we don't have. And it was only later that the Europeans were confident enough to move down to the coast, and which was considered a very dangerous area in any case, open to invasion, open to, you know, plagues and death and so on, and put themselves squarely on the coast. That took an awful long time. In fact, this is curious. You know, the American Atlantic coast, the colonial coast, we find some of the first coastal cities in places like Boston, mm-hmm. Particularly less so in Philadelphia, certainly in Manhattan. These are kind of bold advances for the Americans.
Yeah. I mean, this is precisely what I mean. I mean, I know I'm a Russian historian, and I know that that Moscow, for example, was a city on a river, actually two rivers, and that, that the Russians themselves had a large riparian, I guess I would call it navy, and they moved a lot of trade up and down these rivers, and there was there were docks there, and the Russians built boats. I mean, people think of Peter the Great as the person that founded the Russian Navy. Well, there was already a Russian Navy. It just wasn't a blue water Navy. These kinds of, or you think about London is a great example, because it is not on the coast, although it's on a coastal river. And then later it becomes kind of a center of a blue water Navy, but it wasn't originally. And for many centuries, it wasn't. It was a river town. Yeah.
Well, you see that. You should start sitting down and writing that.
Can you imagine? Oh my goodness! God. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that is quite a project. Rivers. Yeah. Well, you know, all cities were on them. That's basically the story. Is that all cities were on them? It's an interesting thing. So, you know, one of the parts of the book that I really liked was that, and this gets us to modern times, really, and after the Europeans start to, in what we now call the Age of Discovery. Do we still call it that? I don't know.
We can still call it.
Okay. The Europeans go from coast to coast, and they do something rather odd. I don't know if it was odd, but they start to plant colonies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
Well, yeah, once again, the first impulse of Europeans, and the Spanish are sort of one-off in this respect, but the northern Western European countries, when they came to the New World, were very, very hesitant in planting themselves too firmly on the land, in part because of hearing disturbing the Native American populations, but also because just their unfamiliarity with the New World. So for a long time, their so-called ports look more like camps, and certainly the fishing and fur trapping trades were extremely nomadic, so that there was no great urge to settle the land initially, but rather to make contact with the Native Americans who could supply the riches for trade. So again, the coast has this particular strange role in the settlement of America. Yes, it is the place that first contacts were made, but it was a very long time before the Europeans were, shall we say, comfortable with the coast and were willing to invest in the interiors. So that's another peculiarity that I've been exploring here.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you say makes sense. I mean, again, I'm in Western Massachusetts, and you know, the first English or Europeans came and settled in the early part of the 17th century. By mid-century, it's only 50 years later, they were out here, and we're interior. We're really interior.
Yeah, you are interior.
Yeah, we're really interior. They headed towards what is really New York, and they settled out here, and they basically had a hard time, I can tell you that, but they left the coast as quickly as they could for whatever reason.
First of all, I don't think that's true, because the majority of wealth that was initially extracted by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was from the sea and from the trapping trades, so that they quickly found they weren't very good farmers. They weren't in a particularly arable area. So without the fish, as Admiral Morrison pointed out, without God's gift to the fish, there would have been no Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And this is true, interestingly, in a lot of different places, certainly in the Maritimes in Canada, all the way down to Virginia, where, of course, a different kind of economy emerges. But again, there, that's dependent on the sea as well. There would have been no plantation society had not they had the connections with the sea and bringing in the slaves and exporting the tobacco.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think your case is strongest precisely in this period and precisely in the settlement pattern of early North America, where virtually all the major cities are on coasts. It's strikingly different than Europe, where most of the major cities are, in fact, not on coasts and far from coasts. Whereas here, you know, we, for a long time, you know, as you point out, the United States was the coast. That was it. Exactly. It wasn't much else.
Well, we're returning. You know, the irony is, as I point out in my book, that we have once again become a coastal society.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be on the coast now. We talk about the coasts as if they are sort of almost territories, sovereign territories in and of themselves, West Coast, East Coast, the Gulf Coast. It's a very interesting cycle back to this mode of coastal existence.
And something else that happens at this point is the this may be the wrong term, and you don't use it, but the sort of industrial exploitation of the sea. This is the 19th century I'm talking about. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, that occurred rather late, actually, partly for technological reasons. But the ironically, the what you call the industrial exploitation of the sea with power, steam-driven trawlers and all of that thing at the end of the 19th century then severed the sea from the land in its traditional farmer-fisher nexus. So what happened was, in the 20th century, Americans continued to be, industrial fishers, but they ceased to be a seafaring society. You know, Melville, in some ways, Melville's great Moby Dick is at the peak of that engagement with the sea, but it's also the death knell of it as the whaling industry collapsed and the other stuff was industrialized.
Yeah, I mean, that is very interesting because when you go sort of north of Boston, let's put it that way, and I just say that because I have, you know from reading things like Moby Dick and movies and such that it was built on a large fishing and whaling industry, and it's entirely gone. There's just nothing left of it except for a couple of statues.
Well, yeah, it's lost. I mean,
yeah.
Well, we're watching in Maine now the very, very tenuous situation, even of the lobster fishery, which has been thriving of late because with the disappearance of the cod, lobster larvae have survived in huge numbers, and the numbers caught has been at all-time record levels, but who knows? Warmer water may drive them into the waiting hands of the Canadian fishing industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it, because in New England, as you know, there's something called scrod. And scrod is just a generic whitefish. I've never isn't any kind of fish. It's just a generic whitefish, and it's typical. But I do wonder kind of when people started to eat, that is sort of Westerners, let's put it that way, started to think of ocean fish as something that you could just eat. You know, it's like this is a regular part of your diet, you know, fish on Friday. I mean, where I grew up in Kansas, I mean, there was a, you know, we didn't have ocean fish. I mean, we had catfish or something like that, dirty water fish.
I bet you weren't a Catholic either.
No, I wasn't a Catholic either. No, I was not a Catholic. No.
Well, the eating of fish goes back to the Middle Ages. It was sort of a religious injunction. So there's a long history behind that. But Americans, partly because they were Protestant, were not particularly, how would one say, a fish-eating culture until quite recently.
I just am interested in the question of when, like, you know, it become like we're going to go to the market and we're going to get, we're going to get fish and we're going to eat fish tonight. And it's just like, I don't know when exactly that started. So another thing you talk about is,
in our own lifetimes.
I would say that's true. Especially if you think about, I don't know if you've ever read about this, like you ordered Chilean sea bass or something.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't farmed, then if you trace like how it gets to you, It's just remarkable how it gets to you. You know, it involves aircraft. It's going to do all kinds of things, how it gets to your plate. They're at legal seafood, which is probably illegal, but never mind that. And it also turns out that a lot of the fish you eat in fish restaurants isn't what it claims it is.
Exactly.
I wasn't surprised by that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. But here, you know, even on Gott's Island, which has access to the sea and has had wonderful, until recently, mussel beds, nobody on that island ever picked a mussel until probably the 1970s.
When really?
A good friend of ours, who was a medievalist from Princeton, came up. He looked around and said, what the hell is going on here? He harvested the mussels. They feasted on it to like kings for a month or so when they rented our house. And then people began to take notice. But no, it was scorned. In fact, mussels, mollusks, and have generally been scorned even by coastal peoples for cultural reasons, sometimes for political reasons.
Interesting. I remember when I was in graduate school in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and we used to go out to Point Reyes National Seashore, and there you could use such enormous mussel beds. I mean, just huge mussel beds, and I couldn't believe it, all the mussels that and I might have eaten some. I can't say whether I did or not for legal reasons.
Yeah.
For legal reasons, I can't cop to that. But I knew what they were. So, another chapter of your book, which I found really fascinating, is that we exploit the sea and we have these coastal cities and we exploit the sea in sort of an industrial way. And then we sort of discover the sea. It's not just something that we just dredge fish out of or throw our waste in. It's something, and we start to study it. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, to me, it came as quite an interest, quite a surprise to find how late serious study of the sea, which we would now call oceanography or marine science, developed, the forerunner of that kind of intellectual interest in the sea was heavily literary. In other words, Jules Verne was so far ahead of the curve in imagining the sea into being, in comparison to the feeble efforts by scientists and their sovereign indifference to the sea, that this alerted me to this the way I describe it is the discovery of the sea. You know, the age of discovery is the seas are discovered as something to get across to find lucrative trade and riches beyond the next shore. But the sea itself was largely ignored, partly out of fear, partly out of religious injunction, until the 19th century, and then finally science gets interested. But again, it's provoked so often by literature. The imagination precedes the science in these cases, which I think we're finding more and more is the case of how science proceeds, first with imagining a world, and then exploring it in depth.
Well, I don't know anything about the history of marine biology, but I suspect it's a pretty new discipline.
It is very new. We know almost nothing about the great biomass of the sea.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that's probably right. So everybody out there listening, you can become an oceanographer and actually discover something new. Definitely. Yeah. No question about it. You're going to need a lot of grant money, but you can probably discover something new. And then I think, you know, and I remember, of course, you know, there were certain scientists who did a great job of actually popularizing this notion that you could know something about sea. And Jacques Cousteau is the obvious person to mention here. And when I was a kid, you know, I watched these things and it was truly amazing. And it sort of opened my eyes to this world below our world. And then there's also, of course, the notion that the coast itself is a separate ecosystem. It's not the same as the deep water ocean. It's a different beast.
That's where I end up. This is where Rachel Carson is absolutely essential. She didn't go for the big grant, shall we say.
Yeah, right.
In fact, she spent most of her time writing pamphlets for the U.S. government before she launched and wrote these wonderful books, which again, we're not written on grants, and they weren't big science. Right. Her science was not big science, but it was the kind of science that beachcombers and ladies with time on their hands down on the beach with their children had been pursuing since the early 19th century. You know, looking into the tide pools, trying to understand the life that went on there. So she's in a great amateur tradition, ramped up now to a science of great credibility.
Well, I'll be teaching Silent Spring later this year, so I'll be happy to hear that. Yes, I will, absolutely. So, yes, she's appreciated in this corner. And then the last chapter of the book, the substantive chapter, is the most disturbing chapter, and that is the chapter about what's happening now, Coastal Dreams and Nightmares. And you have this, and I don't remember the statistics, so please tell us that in the past 30 or 40 years, I don't remember a lot of people in the United States have moved to the coasts, or maybe worldwide. Can you tell us that?
Yes. It's 15% of American landmass. The coast is now home to 53% of the population. So it's a massive overpopulation. Of course, it's even worse in the coastal cities where, as we saw during Sandy, you know, people have put themselves in a position to be at risk. Mm-hmm. So I'm along with Orrin J. Pilkey and many others, am a very, very harsh critic of coastal policy as it's been developed. And I think it's proving time and time again now. You see the follies of Governor Christie and the way he has used the Sandy crisis for his own personal gain, rather than to look this thing square in the face and say, look, there's only one viable way out of this, and that's relocation. Retreat and relocation. But it's like telling the American Marines, you know, that they should pull back from Pork Chop Hill. It just doesn't go down. There's this strange relationship with the sea that Americans have. Most of them wouldn't know one end of a paddle or from the other, but they are convinced that they have to be the masters of the sea. And in fact, we do have the world's largest navy at this point, a navy that it's hard to tell what the purpose of it is, except to keep the trade routes open, and that's a good enough one, I suppose. But, you know, the distance between the politics of the sea and the reality of the sea is a huge one.
Well, most of that navy is scattered around the world. I mean, it's not. It's a wonderful. I can remember even when I lived in San Francisco or Berkeley that when part of it would come into the bay, I was really happy because I could see it. You know, you see an aircraft carrier, like, oh, there's our navy, and it goes to the Oakland shipyards. But usually, you don't see it at all. It's like not there.
Well, you usually don't see your army.
No, you don't. You never see your army. That you can't even hope to see. Yeah, you can't even hope to see. But the movement of people to the coast is increased, hasn't it? It's accelerated over time.
No, it's accelerating every day. And what's interesting about this is happening all around the world. European coasts are chock-a-block now with condominiums. Even in Africa, which has been the great, you know, dark continent, interior continent, is now moving toward the shores. So, and this requires a cultural explanation. One of the things that I hope to engage people in this book is their own fondness for the shore, their own desire for the shore, and also paired with, as you say, desire and nightmare. The shore is a beloved and much desired place, but it is also a place of nightmarish experience, and that needs to be explained. I mean, it's not by accident that Jaws shows up, you know, in your state, actually.
Yeah, right.
For example, the mythology of the shark, which is most sharks are very passive and don't attack. But why is it that we've chosen them as the as a sort of icon of the ferocious nature. Not entirely clear.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is just to sit and think. You don't even have to sit on the shore to contemplate this, but there's a feeling, there's a subjectivity that one encounters at the shore, which is different from any other place. And that is one of my quests. I'm still working on it to try to understand this particular fascination and repulsion, because it's really an ambivalent feeling in the end about water.
Yeah, I know that one of the peculiar things for me as a Midwesterner, when I first went to a coastal city and I first moved to San Francisco, actually I moved to Berkeley, is that you actually never see the ocean. you're right there next to it, but you don't ever see it. It's like you just don't see it. And then I moved to Boston. I lived there for a dozen years. In Boston, you really never see the ocean. Like you have to work to get out there to see it.
Yes, exactly.
And I didn't work very hard.
Things are a little bit different now with the redevelopment of the Embarcadero out here to try to bring people down to the edge of the sea or to the bay. And the new Exploratorium is a wonderful launching or a prospect for reintegrating land and sea with all kinds of exhibits and child-friendly explorations. So we're getting back to the sea. My great fear is, though, that the developers are going to get there first. Well, they've always gotten there first, and what we need to do is keep them at bay long enough that we can actually establish a workable relationship, a sustainable relationship between populations and the sea.
Right. I mean, it's... Why do you think people want to move toward the coast? Why do people want to come move to? I mean, I understand why young people want to move to a place like San Francisco or Boston. You know, exciting and stuff like that. But why this drive to? Is it just an accident that these places are there and they want to end up? Or
no. I think the sea, seaports, sea shores, evoke a frontier along. Well. I mean, I think Americans long for the frontier. They long for a place from which they can project themselves mentally, if not physically, into or beyond to the horizon. And there's no place that the horizon is more available, unobstructed than the seashore. So if you read the literature, if you read some good travel writers, and you read people like Melville, he says we're water gazers, and by that he means that we are engaged in some kind of mental and spiritual, emotional pursuit at the shore that can't be replicated anyplace else or is difficult to replicate. And the shore has been, by the way, until quite recently, a democratic place. That is, it was not initially colonized. Chock-a-block. There were large open spaces that people could come down to the shore, set up a tent. It was a common land. I mean, if Americans, they don't have much sense of the commons anymore. It's all private property. But the lure of a place, a democratic place, which we can share with our neighbors, is a lure in and of itself.
I see. One of the things you say in your book, and I'm very interested in topography myself, so urban topography, is that, and this you can see in San Francisco and in Boston, that the docks are gone, or if they're preserved, they're there for tourists, because the real docks are someplace else where there are container ships.
Long gone.
I don't know if you've ever been to one of those places where they keep the container ships, but they're incredible.
Well, I'm looking out my window right now. This will evoke envy and hatred. And I'm looking over toward Oakland, and there I see the crane.
Yeah.
And then I can look over through the Golden Gate past Alcatraz.
Right.
And see an occasional liner will come in. But the vast majority of the traffic is now with the container ships, and those are the sailor towns. Well, they're not sailor towns because Those sailors never get off the ships. They turn around in a matter of hours. There's no docking. There's only a kind of a pause.
And you can't go down there. There's not like an ecosystem of people down there. You can't go down there and wander around.
No.
There's a fence.
No.
they don't let you wander around down there.
You'll be arrested.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all under the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
Has made of the dock areas, not every shore, but many, many of the most attractive shore areas are now off limits. At Gott's Island, we cannot leave a bag of groceries on the dock unattended because, they'll swoop down and say, "What's that? What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you trying to blow this place up?" I mean, it's that level of stupid paranoia that is making these places uninhabitable.
I just find, one of the things you mentioned is the I don't know how to put it, but the great well of stories, which was the harbor town with docks. And when you think of San Francisco, it's still in my mind, San Francisco it's a sailor's town. And Manhattan is this place where all these people came and they were all came on in ships and they disembarked, in Manhattan, and they sort of came in their droves and they did all kinds of wacky things that you couldn't even believe. And all that's gone. I mean, it's completely gone.
It's all gone.
Yeah.
Phil Lopate has a very interesting, it's a study of the water. It's called The Waterfront, and he observes exactly that. And, it's a kind of elegy in some ways. But, of course, you might have wanted to go down and stare at these sailors and their malls and so on, but you wouldn't want to live the life that they lived. I mean, the sailor's life was at the bottom of the proletariat.
No, I'm not saying that it was a particularly attractive life, but as a kind of cultural zone that existed for a long time, it's now, and this is true of the Thames as well, and it's true of Amsterdam, that these places are all gone now. They've moved the container ships have their own places, and they go to those places, and then they, do the container thing, and then they leave. And you're right, the 6 to 8 people who run the ship never get off.
Well, this is why I say right off the bat in the book, I say the coasts are our most altered environment. I can't think of another place, unless it's a nuclear waste dump or something like that, where a vast part of America has been changed so radically in such a short time.
Right.
And that it's worth thinking about and alerting people to as they come down to look at the shore and wonder what once existed there.
Yeah.
And,
it's funny because I lived in Seattle in the 1980s, and I often tell people that I lived in Seattle I used to tell people that I lived in Seattle, which is a harbor town. I lived in Seattle when it was Portland. And what they understood by that was, well, Portland's really down and out.
Yeah.
Now I can't even say that. Because Portland is a different thing now. Because when I lived in Seattle, it was really poor. I mean, it was poor. Boeing was laying people off. It was like going through this transition. I rented a house with a friend of mine for, I think we paid $300 or $400 for 3 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, just unimaginable today. And it was kind of gritty, just unimaginable. But now even Portland is, something
different. Partially, you've had a good life.
Well, I've moved around a lot. I've lived everywhere. I really have lived everywhere. I've seen it all. And there are nice folks all over the place, I'll tell you that. So one thing I want to ask you is I wanted to ask you one last thing, and that is Americans are moving to the coasts.
Yeah.
And I guess given our current principles and given the way we run things, the way we make decisions, there's no way to stop them. Is there?
No, it's a free choice, but we can constrain the way they use the coasts through. And California has been a leader in environmental protection of its coasts. I think very admirable. Maine and Massachusetts have done well. But I think the crucial thing is education to understand the coast as a natural and human phenomena, vital to our the health of our species as well as many others, and then maybe people will get on board in limiting some of the worst excesses of coastal walling, these terrible so-called sand dumps, where the first thing is done is, beach washes out and they come in and replace it with not even with sand. I mean, it's gotten so out of hand. It's big business run rampant. Another thing we could do is constrain the Army Corps of Engineers, which I think is close to being like the National Intelligence Agency, a kind of rogue agency that does whatever it wants without really much appreciation for the democratic spirit. There are lots of things. I'd like to restore the coast to a much more democratic condition, a much more ecologically friendly condition, but I'd like to restore it. I'd like to think of it as home. Get people starting to think about the coast as home, the shore as home, the original home of mankind, and maybe, just maybe, like they treat old houses and, old neighborhoods, there'll be a respect that will be restored, which will have salutary effects. That's what I'm hoping.
Well, if the climatologists are right, that respect will be restored with absolutely catastrophic results.
Yeah.
So,
But coasts and shores do heal themselves. I'm not quite so pessimistic as many are on this sea rise and climate change thing. I think there's a lot. This isn't the first time that seas have risen and storms have blown and catastrophes have occurred on the shore.
Yeah, I mean it's funny because I'm not really a Midwesterner anymore, but I lived there a lot, and I can tell you that people in the Midwest have very great respect for rivers, because every time the scientists say it's a 1,000-year flood and it can't happen, another one happens, and then the Mississippi overflows its banks, or these things can like change their course in your lifetime. We understand this is serious stuff, and they move towns sometimes.
It's very serious. If we had had Melville is not really a man of the shore. He has some things to say about. But if we had a Mark Twain of the shore, I think we'd be in a very different position today.
I was going to ask you about that. You kind of have the two great American people, the contestants for the great American novel being Moby Dick and Huck Finn, and one's on the ocean and one's on the river. I lived in Iowa for a while. I lived in Iowa for 7 years, and I can tell you that the Mississippi culture is alive and well. It's different there than it is other places. I went right up and down it, and it's not there like it was in Twain, but it's there. It's a vibrant thing, the Mississippi, and it can't be dominated, and people understand that. Even the Army Corps of Engineers understand that there's just nothing you can do about the Mississippi. It's too big.
No, the ships are still moving, and you have somebody like John McPhee wrote about one of the barges. Very interesting book. Yeah. Books are always interesting.
Yeah, so I got to get to work on that history of rivers.
Get going.
That would take me for a while.
Connecticut right next door.
I do have the Connecticut. You're absolutely right. The beautiful Connecticut, which is beautiful, I have to say. I really like it. It's gorgeous. So anyway, John, we've taken up a lot of your time. This has been really fun. I want to ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, you caught me at a slack moment, in fact, a kind of frenetic moment trying to inventory all the things I would like to do. And I think what I'm most interested in right now is finding something that leads on from the shore, perhaps to the idea of question of boundaries, the history of boundaries, how we set boundaries, how we set edges, and so on. But I'm I'm open to suggestions.
How about a history of rivers? Rivers?
Oh boy. You know, I don't think I've got the, I've never lived on a river. I've fished small streams, but not big rivers. I just don't think I have the feel for it.
Yeah, right. Well, somebody out there will do it, and it'll be a great book, because rivers are super, super important. Everybody knows that. So anyway, let me first say we've been talking with John Gillis about his book, The Human Shore, Seacoast in History. And let me say thank you, John, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And finally, let me say that I am Marshall Poe, and I am the host of New Books in History and the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And I want to wish everyone who listens to this podcast and the other podcasts on the network a good week.